Welcome to Countersign. In these podcasts, I discuss books, films, and other materials with their authors and creators. This is the second series of Countersign. You can catch up on series one wherever you get your podcasts or by visiting countersignisapodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We welcome your feedback. More details at countersignisapodcast.com. Tanya Sarissia is a colleague of mine at Birkbeck. She's a sophisticated thinker who combines philosophical insights with politically and empirically grounded research. Her book, Speaking Out, Feminism, Rape and Narrative Politics, asks the really important question of what 50 years of breaking the silence about rape and sexual assault has achieved. Starting with consciousness-raising speak-outs of second-wave feminists in the 1970s and working her way to Me Too social media activism of recent times, Tanya treats survivor speech as a narrative genre of feminist politics. Telling the story of surviving rape or sexual assault has enormous affective power. It has this power, according to Tanya, because feminism has created a genre of speaking out that contains particular conventions, rules, and boundaries that achieve certain political objectives. Drawing on Jacques Derrida's essay, The Law of Genre, Tanya explains how belonging to a genre can constrain, confine, and overly determine the kinds of stories that can be told. The prevalence of narratives about assault by strangers, combined with a carceral politics that seeks particular criminal justice outcomes, can lead to an extremely skewed and unidimensional set of narratives around sexual violence. Drawing on philosophers such as Adriana Cavarero and Jean-Francois Lyotard, Tanya asks what it would mean to create a different vision for speaking out, one that is more aware of the ambivalences in recounting any particular experience, the sense that no life is determined by one experience or a single event, that our stories are multidimensional and contain ambiguities and ambivalences. She points to the dangers of the collective force of a hashtag, for instance, becoming the story and thereby overshadowing or marginalizing other voices. The alternative vision for speaking out that Tanya suggests places listening at the heart of political and ethical practices. Central to this are the conditions under which speech is heard, when collective listening, witnessing, and believing can take place. And that sometimes means that one has to be silent. As Tanya explains, the political outcome of speaking out is not immediately apparent. And this means that we need to think about speech as a political tool, what narrative does, and how value is attached to it. A warning that this episode of Countersign contains a discussion of rape and sexual violence that some listeners might find distressing and disturbing. If you are affected by the issues raised here and require support, please contact the agencies in your location or country. Welcome, Tanya. Thank you for joining me on Countersign. I found your book, Speaking Out, feminism, rape, and narrative politics, incredibly rich and fruitful to read at a number of different levels. And I'm sort of, in a sense, immediately kind of intrigued that you started with Susan Brownmiller's book, mm-hmm. Against Our Will, Men, Women, and Rape, which was published in 1975. And I suppose what intrigued me was what we take for granted now. So when we look at the discussions in the 1970s that Brownmiller and other feminists were having, the question was actually whether rape and sexual assault should even be a feminist issue.
Yeah.
So I found that actually looking at it from today's perspective, a surprise. And so I thought we would start with your own sort of reflections on that moment, as that's what you start the book with.
Okay, well, first to say thank you very much for taking the time with the book and also to have me on the podcast. I've been looking forward to this. It's a very a nice way to end the week. But it is really interesting, I think, the point that you've just made, because the question of history and historical change and feminism's role in that is actually one of the impetuses, I guess, behind the book, because I think that the point you make that it's not that long ago, it's about 50 years, but it's very difficult for us to think back to the way that sexual violence and rape was positioned politically, socially, culturally, discursively. And at one level, that's about thinking about how generative of change that moment and the things that arise from it was. And I'm talking about the early 1970s and the first public speak out on rape that I talk about, and then Brownmiller's book. Feminist understandings of that are often very ahistorical. And it's interesting, one response I had from someone I know who read the book was about speaking out itself. And she said, I'd never thought of it as a political strategy or a political choice. I just always thought it was something that we had to do and survivors had to do. And the kind of, naturalization of that and reification of that, and I know we'll talk about it in more detail, but that there's kind of a natural impetus for survivors to tell their story, and that's a natural good and is obviously connected to certain kinds of change, was something that seemed to me to be so ingrained in feminist politics and so embedded. And as I talk about it, it had a kind of strange effect in that people had been talking, for 50 years about breaking the silence. But what it did was actually shut down conversations about what Tanya Horrock calls the public volubility of rape, or the effects of speech and discourse around sexual violence, the effect of feminism itself, and actually tracing those changes. And so what I wanted to do in the book, in a sense, was bring that back into a political framework through bringing it back into history. I think the Brownmiller example is really important for a whole range of reasons, but one of them is the reason that you highlight, that we need actually to go back and see what early kind of second wave feminists were saying about rape and sexual violence to even think about how we can reflect on the cultural and political changes that have occurred around it.
That's a really important sort of framing. So it's partly about thinking about historical change and the way in which historical change is brought about by feminist politics. And of course, in the course of the book, as one reads across the eight chapters, one of the immediate things that comes to mind is that, of course, like all political movements and historical change, it is by no means a linear process. And it is by no means one where there is a political consensus about what the objectives or processes are. So I want you to maybe talk a little bit about that, the sort of non-linearity of it. As a project, what you do in the book is you you identify a genre of speaking out about rape, which is in the form of memoirs and autobiographies that involve breaking the silence, as you referred to it. And the authors of these memoirs and autobiographies, and of course that's not the only material that you deal with, there's other material as well, but we'll get to that. But the authors of these memoirs and autobiographies, you know, don't have the same political horizons as other feminists would. So in some cases don't even identify as feminists. So I wondered if you could say a little bit more about the genre of material that you work with, the different genres of material. And I think that could then also speak to the sort of non-linearity of the progress of historical change in relation to sexual violence.
Yeah, okay. So as you say, it's not just about the genre of memoirs, but the genre of memoirs was actually where I started empirically. And I think that's worth saying that for me, looking back at the book, and we were talking briefly about theory before we started recording, but it was very much a process of going back and forth between empirical materials, looking for theoretical concepts and tools that could help unpack them, you know, a kind of grounded approach to theory. And so where the real conceptual framework started was in this genre of memoirs. And maybe I can talk a little bit later about why I was actually interested in the question, but I found that I wanted to look at survivor speech, because it seemed to me that this insistence that survivor speech sits at the heart of feminist politics around rape was something that needed to be tackled critically, because you find it in activism, you find it in academia, you find it everywhere, but there was never really an interrogation of it. And there was also this strange sense that, particularly within feminism, that people knew what survivors as a kind of undifferentiated group were saying and thought, but there was never any real attempt to, you know, to put that in any kind of empirical basis. And so what I thought I would do is try to, as a first step, actually go and engage with texts. I now have a collection of about 80 kind of autobiographical texts, and there are more and more coming out all the time. And in terms of those questions you're talking about with non-linearity, I mean, the first thing to say is that there's definite peaks of publishing. And you can see that as related to cultural moments where there's an interest either in feminism and sexual violence, so particularly at the end of the 1980s, which is a period that I've written about, particularly at the end of the 1990s, which fits into a kind of broader cultural moment of what's sometimes called misery lit or trauma autobiography. And autobiographies of sexual violence are kind of a subset within that. And then the last few years, particularly from 2015 to today, which has seen, you know, as well as Me Too, a kind of upsurge in interest in sexual violence in online politics. There is a really clear shift in them over time in terms of their relationship to feminism. And, you know, this is something that you mentioned. So the earliest book I have, which is called Into the Dark Woods by Jennifer Barr, the 1979 one, talks a lot about feminist consciousness raising groups. It's actually an book from the UK. Feminist consciousness raising groups, or what she calls rap groups, about the way that she had no language to speak about or understand her experience of sexual violence until she discovered these feminist groups, and that in understanding she was sexually assaulted by a stranger in the woods, which is where the title comes from. But in coming to a more kind of political understanding of her sexual assault, of why she felt so ashamed about it. She actually then went back and reconsidered other kind of relationship and sexual experiences she'd had earlier. So it's a very kind of classic feminist narrative of coming to consciousness. And for her, feminism plays just a kind of completely almost liberatory role in helping her to speak and to get out what she's talking about. So you have this very almost organic relationship to feminism in these very early texts in the late 70s and early 1980s. You come forward to the 1990s and that really changes. So the relationships to feminism range from, I would say, ambivalence to hostility. And the way they talk about it is far less about, you know, mm-hmm. I didn't have a language and then I discovered feminism and I did, to, you know, I had this traumatic experience. And then as I was trying to come to terms with it, I felt that feminism, which is often experienced kind of institutionally and often experienced as a kind of ally with the criminal justice system, but in the sense of rape crisis centers, certain modes of counseling, you know, I felt like feminism was attempting to already tell me what had happened to me and how I should feel about it and how I should understand it politically before I had the opportunity to make sense of it myself. So far from kind of going from being a liberating experience or a liberating discourse, it was experienced as being much more constraining. And so I was talking before about, you know, using empirical mm-hmm. materials then to go to theory. And it was Bakhtin, actually, who really helped me to think about this. And what he says is that society is constructed of socially significant languages. And these socially significant languages draw words and concepts into their orbit. And, mm-hmm. you know, so what I saw was, and this is to go back to the issue with Susan Brown Miller as well, that in the early 1970s, feminists actually, as feminism began to become a socially significant language, drew sexual violence and rape into their orbit and thereby changed its meaning from being a kind of isolated attack by a deviant psychopath to something with political significance for the politics of gender. But as you move forward into the late 1980s and 1990s, almost in a way, feminism's success in claiming the significance, the importance of rape and sexual violence means that it begins to be pulled into other orbits. So you see, for instance, psychology, psychiatry, you know, talking about rape and rape trauma syndrome, staking a claim as a socially significant language. And you see survivors beginning to talk about, you know, their experience in those terms, in terms of trauma, in terms of PTSD. You see the criminal justice system responding to feminist demands to take rape more seriously, and actually survivors finding, in certain circumstances, criminal justice as a means to express their understandings. And, you know, this coincides with the growth of the victims' rights movements as well in the late 1980s and 1990s. So you have some rape survivors writing memoirs who are actually founders or very active in victims' rights movements in a kind of penal populist politics. And at the same time, and this is another thing that Bakhtin talks about, feminism itself changes. So Bakhtin says that these socially significant languages can occupy two kind of main forms. You have oppositional discourses, which are denied kind of social authority and legitimacy, but which speak directly to kind of people's experience that come up from below. And then you have authoritative discourses that have institutional force and power behind them. And they're often perceived as people as being something external. And so it seemed to me that at the same time that you have rape and sexual violence become a much more significant social topic and so move between different discourses, you also have feminism, and this has been talked about by a lot of other people, becoming more institutionalized, becoming more respectable, and not being experienced the same way by survivors, but actually sometimes being experienced as similar to a discourse like psychology, psychiatry, you know, like criminal justice discourses. So, you know, so just looking at this genre of memoirs, I could mm-hmm. see a lot of change and a lot of quite contradictory changes coming out of, you know, this trajectory of speaking out and the way that it moved over time.
Yes. No, I think that was, I mean, that's one of the things that really comes through in the book. And it's one of the reasons, if you like, for your analysis of different instances of speaking out. So if you were to sort of see it simplistically, more simplistically, that, you know, we would have binaries like stranger rape as the most serious form of rape, and that is elevated beyond other forms of sexual violence in the context of date rape, for example. So those sorts of contrasting positions can, in a sense, be understood both in terms of carceral politics and the place of criminal justice as a institutional response to sexual violence, and alongside that, or on the other hand, feminist understandings of rape and sexual violence as a form of patriarchal power. From that, I think it might be useful to come to how it is narrative and storytelling that you focus on, because one of the other things that you point to, and in a sense the point of departure of the book, is that you treat speaking out as a narrative-based politics, that it is about telling a story, and in some instances it's about breaking the silence, which is a phrase that keeps mm-hmm. coming up in the context of these genres of biographies. But I wondered if you could say a little bit more about how you came to treat it in that way as a narrative-based politic.
Okay, so I guess it might help. I said I'd go back to the kind of origins of the project overall, and it might help to do that briefly now.
Yeah, that would help.
So I was doing the equivalent in Australia, an honours thesis, which would be more like a master's thesis in the UK. And at the same time, I was working in women's health and in the sector in Australia and New South Wales that does rape crisis. And I did my honours thesis on a kind of, I suppose, a moral panic, an event that occurred in the early 2000s, which was a series of gang rapes by a couple of different groups of men that were connected in kind of mainstream media discourse and political discourse and also police as essentially Muslim gang rapes of white Australian women. And so it was very much kind of post September 11 and a very racialized discourse around this. And what I was interested in and what disturbed me kind of working in the sector and in terms of my scholarship was that feminism in a kind of, you know, very crude institutionalized form didn't really have a response to these very kind mm-hmm. of racialized and racist discourses taking up this mantle of speaking on behalf of survivors and, you know, wanting to take survivors' voices seriously and listen to survivors. And there were, you know, legislation was proposed that changed group sexual assault in company to become the highest tier of offenses alongside homicide. At the same time, all these other kind of anti-gang legislation was introduced, making it easier, for instance, for police to stop and search groups of people in cars. And the only response that kind of the Rape Crisis Center, other feminist organizations had was to say, it's really good that these stories are being taken seriously, you know, but we have to remember that rape occurs across all races and ethnicities. And to me, that just didn't actually engage with the politics of what was going on at all. Which mm-hmm. wasn't in any way to be taking sexual violence seriously in terms of respecting, you know, women's right to bodily autonomy. It was a very kind of, you know, our women are being assaulted by these men discourse. And so I was really wanting, in a sense, to look at why it was that there was no real response. And I think that there's a lot of critical work in this area over the last kind of 10, 20 years that's really been motivated by a sense that feminist politics around sexual violence has reached a series of impasses. And so a lot of people have looked at the failings of law reform, for instance. There are obviously big debates about carceral politics. But what I was interested in was more the cultural politics, and I suppose the notion of what it meant to take sexual violence seriously. And this is where I saw that this idea of, you know, listening to survivors, being led by survivors, was such a crucial part of feminist belief in this area. And what I mean by that is there was a real belief that this is what feminists did, you know, that we disseminated, amplified the voices of survivors, and also that doing this was the solution to the political problem of sexual violence, and that everything else, rape law reform, engaging in prosecutions, doing rape crisis work, followed from this. It became clear to me that speaking out is imagined to do three things. And so first, it, as I say, transforms a kind of silenced and subjugated victim into a heroic speaking survivor. So it's an individual empowerment. In so doing, when the survivor speaks, you know, she opens up a space that can allow other survivors to come forward. So it's almost like a kind of trickle-down logic. And finally, the cumulative impact of that speech is seen to produce kind of overall cultural and political change. So when I first started to think about it, I thought the solution is to look in terms of performative speech, you know, speech that does something in the Austinian sense, that it has mm-hmm. effects in the world. But I realized as I began to actually look at survivor discourse that I felt that that was in a way a misnaming. It wasn't that it was a simple declaration, you know, coming out and saying, I am a survivor of sexual violence or I have been raped. That wasn't the speech that was seen to do something. It's actually speaking out always means telling a story. And I think this is true in the sense of hashtags as well, which we can talk about in a bit later if you like. Mm-hmm. But it's not, the political power doesn't reside in the declaration. You know, the power resides in the narrative. And this is also true, I think, in debates and discussions over legal testimony. And Wendy Larkham has written about this, you know, the affective power of women's testimony in a sexual violence trial and kind of the law's fear of that power, basically. But it became clear to me that what speaking out does is harness this kind of affective political power of narrative and the ability to tell a story. And I think when I then started to work with that as an idea and to think what feminism has done in this, you know, mm-hmm. in these years from the 1970s onwards, is created a genre. And this is also why narrative was so useful to me, because it was about thinking about genre as opening a cultural space where stories could be told and heard in ways that they weren't before. So you have this idea that there is this survivor narrative of speaking out, and it has an audience, first with feminists and gradually a wider audience. But at the same time, when you create a genre, and this is going back to Derrida, you also create a set of boundaries or constraints. Genres only work if they have rules and if they exclude, you know, so a genre is never completely open. It both enables and constrains. That was something that I saw as well, that there was actually a pattern of speech, a very similar narrative pattern that was in the memoirs that I looked at, that was in the public stories that I looked at in other forums, such as magazines, such as academic accounts that were collected or activist accounts. And also, and you mentioned this briefly before, in the types of stories that were told. So one of the things when I began to collect the memoirs that very quickly became incredibly striking was that nearly all of them were accounts of stranger rape, and nearly all of them were accounts by white women. And a very a disproportionate number of them were actually accounts of interracial rape as well. And so thinking about genre actually enabled me to engage with that critically. You know, if I have inadvertently, through looking for these texts, just only found narratives by white women and that tell a certain story, I suppose there are two options. The first one is that you kind of change what you're doing or what you look for. And the second was to say there's something important here. And that second option is what I decided would be more useful, is I thought, you know, there is this genre that's being constructed, but there are clear generic boundaries around them. And one of them is around race, and others are around the types of stories that can be told, and then others are around the way that stories can be told. So you can't really write a rape memoir, for instance, that says, you know, I was sexually assaulted and it was bad, but it wasn't the worst thing that happened to me. That's not part of the rules of the genre. You know, it has to be what Susan Bryson, who's a philosopher and has also written a survivor narrative that's a work of philosophy, calls a reverse conversion narrative. You know, one of the genre rules is that it's a story of what she calls a perfectly good and intact life that's destroyed by this singular act of violence and then pieced back together again. And so that mode of telling, which is part of the genre, becomes part of the reason that you have a quite exclusionary set of boundaries around who tells the stories, because there's a lot of writing, as you would know, I know, by women from the global south, by women of color, that which does talk about sexual violence, but doesn't tell the story in that way, where it is a story just of sexual violence, of a perfectly good life that's shattered by a singular act of violence. You know, people like Maya Angelou, the Guatemalan writer Rigoberta Menchú, they tell stories that recount, you know, structural and often ongoing patterns of violence, of which sexual violence is an important part, but isn't a kind of singular narrative moment that you can center a text around. And that's a difference. And that's where you get, you know, narratives that do that, that center a text or a story around this singular moment, become very clearly part of this feminist genre that increasingly from the 1970s onwards gets understood socially as the story of rape, and other stories don't.
Yes. And in a sense, the I mean, what you bring out, particularly through the very important notion of genre that you draw from Jacques Derrida's essay, The Law of Genre, is that a genre carries conventions, almost rules of membership. You can belong to a genre if you practice membership in the genre in a particular way. So, and what you've been telling us about is the way in which speaking out about rape has therefore developed this fairly dominant set of conventions, that of the heroic survivor who breaks the silence, who therefore creates a space for others to speak about their own experiences, and that somehow this would lead to overall social change and political transformation around women's bodies, autonomy, and sexual violence. And I think what you get to, the complexity, the ambivalences around experiences of sexual violence that are not only about stranger rape, but in context of incest, or where sexual violence is not with attacked by a stranger, but where there might be ambivalent feelings or a whole mixture of feelings that one has having survived sexual violence, that it's not the only, that there's not only one story to tell. And I think you refer to the feminist philosopher Adriana Cavarero as someone who makes the point about the importance of how our experiences and subjectivities are formed by a conglomeration of events that constitute a single life, and it's not one event. And I think the other very important sort of theoretical and philosophical insight you draw on is Lyotard's notion of the differend, that I think one sort of result of a dominant genre of speaking out is that you end up with the what Lyotard refers to as the referent not being present. This also can be seen, I think, in your discussion of hashtag activism, that it involves a set of conventions that one has to conform to. So it's saying me too, but me too in a particular way.
Yeah, it's saying me too in a particular way and to construct a particular kind of subject. And I think that what is useful in looking at both Cavarero and Lyotard is, you know, that Cavarero makes quite clear that in a sense, autobiography, but particularly autobiography that focuses around a particular, you know, a unidimensional heroic narrative does a form of violence to a life, you know, and the complexity of a life story. And this was also one of the things that when I actually went to look at and try to read and engage closely with what survivors had said, that was very clear in a lot of narratives, that feminists and feminism has imagined that speaking out, you know, is an almost solely kind of empowering or liberatory experience, and that the only danger is really in being disbelieved in a quite obvious and crude way. But what you see through the writings of survivors a lot is the dangers and the ambivalence even of being believed, of having the story taken, but of that transforming you into this very one-dimensional figure of the raped woman or the girl who was raped. And this is what, you know, there's a lot of, you see this again and again, where people will say, magically, I became a story that other people owned, that other people could tell. And this is, you know, one of the effects as well that they would talk about with feminism. You know, I met someone from the Rape Crisis Center and they already knew who I was and what had happened to me and what I had to do. You know, and so in telling this story, it's almost that the story becomes too much and you get stuck within it. And you have often this quite anguished relationship between an attempt to rebuild subjectivity after, you know, a very traumatic event, and feeling that the story itself becomes overwhelming. And this is, I am connecting back to your question. And this is also the case almost in an accelerated form when you come to hashtag activism and to participating in that activism, and the fact that it's quite clear that you then cannot completely control the meaning that is given to your story, because it's so dependent, you know, by its nature on the collective force, the collective power of the hashtag, which means, you know, as I speak about, there is, you know, literally a multitude. I mean, if we talk about something like Me Too, a literal multitude of individual stories, but that then are transformed into a single overarching story. And so it almost goes beyond a split between genre and individual narratives, where the genre itself becomes the story. And so you see, for instance, Time magazine giving its Person of the Year to the Silence Breakers collectively in the aftermath of Me Too. And, you know, there's a question there around what Cavarero is interested in, you know, how you actually relate politically and philosophically to people. And she's particularly interested in women as full subjects, as fully human, when you're constructing this very kind of singular and reductive story. And then going back to the other points that I was talking about, there is who can exercise influence or control over what that story is and what it becomes, you know, and whose interests and realities it reflects. And, you know, the kind of most, the clearest way that we see that is in the story of Tarana Burke and her, I would say, you know, invested.
We're saying a little bit about who Tarana Burke is.
Invested in an ambivalent relationship to me too. So Tarana Burke is a community activist, an African-American community activist who actually coined the phrase Me Too as a response to sexual violence in 2006, using it in her work mainly with, as she says, brown and black girls. So she worked mainly with youth, with young women who were teenagers. Then the hashtag takes off in, you know, a decade later. And at first, there's no recognition of this history of Black women's organizing behind it. You know, the original story is that the hashtag has completely to do with Harvey Weinstein, that it comes from the actor Alyssa Milano, who sent the first tweet. Then quite quickly, you know, because we're in an accelerated domain of social media, you do see African-American activists on Twitter, magazines and publications like Ebony in the US beginning to say, wait a minute, there's a history here that is different and that's not being accounted for. And so then you have Tarana Burke brought into this new moment of Me Too and recognized. But as she says, there's a, and I'm actually going to use my own words here, but I'll quote her in a second, but it becomes a kind of liberal narrative of incorporation almost, you know, oh, well, at first we didn't recognize Black women's leadership, but then we did. And, you know, so everything was fine. You know, in the end, we still have this story that can tell the story of contemporary sexual violence in the US or internationally. But Burke has been a lot more critical and a lot more ambivalent. And, you know, she says that it's possible to be recognized and erased at the same time, you know, that she can be there as a legitimating figure without her leadership and her analysis being taken into account and without her insistence that she's always had on the specificity, the particularity and the importance of Black and brown women and girls' experience of sexual violence and of the way that that's impacted by racism, by systemic poverty, by other forms of discrimination. Because in the overall Me Too story, it becomes again much more that exceptional event that ruins an otherwise kind of good life. And even for something that, you know, really originally occurs in the context of sexual violence and harassment at work, is very divorced from considerations around the labor market, around the gendered power dynamics of labor, you know, that sees, that presents sexual violence again as this kind of exceptionalized narrative moment that, you know, destroys a life and that can only be told in this kind of singular and one-dimensional way. One of the things that I did for the book was look comparatively at media coverage of Me Too, mainly in US publications, but in, you know, kind of mainstream women's magazines, and then African-American publications like Ebony, magazines like Vogue, like Glamour, even things like Newsweek were just like, this has never happened before. This is world changing. You know, things will never be the same. It's a revolution. It's a watershed. The columns in Ebony, there were many that were really asking, is this going to change things? Is this going to change things for Black women, particularly? Again, you know, if you talk about genre and the kind of boundaries around genre, you actually didn't see those two conversations crossing those generic boundaries.
Yes, I mean, I think one of the things that you certainly point to in relation to hashtag activism is also these conventions of genre, as you say. And I want to get to talking about the law of the law of genre, as you draw from Derrida as well, which is that there are ways in which the stories can be usefully contaminated, be more disruptive, break the rules and conventions. And you've been recounting some of the instances of that as well. But overall, there's a sort of sense, I think, as we get towards the end of the book, of, I'm not sure whether ambivalence is the right word, but certainly a, and I think you used the word, a more utopian sort of quest for not only speaking out, but a different set of practices for listening, certainly. So I wanted you to say a little bit more about that. And also, and I suppose take, I think you very importantly point out that part of what one has to do in listening is also to not be speaking or not be speaking in the same way. So to sort of change the practices of speaking and speaking out. And also you draw from, you know, Wendy Brown's notion of wounded subjects and wounded identities. And again, I think you manifest a kind of ambivalence about at least the practices, the dominant practices of speaking out and speech as action, and seek a kind a different kind of horizon, A, certainly, where we wouldn't need to speak about rape and sexual violence because it ceases to be the reality that it is, but also in order to speak about and conceive of one's life in a in all its complexity. I think that's the other sort of driving element in this that you sort of draw from Cavarero and others.
Okay, there were quite a few questions in there.
Yeah.
what I might do. All
you right, can take right,
whichever
one
I might
you
do
want.
Is say a little bit about listening and then come back to this idea of utopian horizons and politics.
Yes.
So I think listening is incredibly important because one of the things that I think has been lacking in feminist analyses or understandings of speaking out, and you can tell there's a lot that I think has been lacking because I don't think until recent years there's been a lot of critical attention to it, is the collective elements. And so there's been a lot of debates back and forth between people saying, you know, survivor speech is incredibly amazing feminist speech, and other people talking about it as individualized, neoliberal, you know, it can't really be resistant because it's not a collective practice. But all of that retains a focus on speech as a kind of singular or exceptional act and doesn't engage with Walter Benjamin's notion of the community of listeners that's required for any storytelling, any speech. And so when I talk about feminism constructing a genre, it is constructing that space where speech is able to be heard. And so in the end, I think the collective element of feminist politics in terms of speaking out is around that listening, around having a collective, what Lee Gilmore calls an adequate witness to testimony, but a collective form of listening that's prepared to, you know, listen, to believe, to amplify and disseminate. But all of these involve, you know, not speaking. And often I think that's been ignored. And the importance of that for solidarity has been ignored. And the main example that I use of that in the book is a case study from Australia, which is from the early 1990s and is known amongst kind of Australian feminists as the Bell Debate. And
yes, that's so important. Yes.
What happened there is a white American anthropologist published an article in Women's Studies International Forum about rape and sexual violence in Indigenous communities in the Northern Territory, so remote Aboriginal communities. And the article was published with an Indigenous woman, Topsy Naparula Nelson, listed as the co-author. And the title of the article was "Speaking About Rape is Everybody's Business." And it's, as many people have commented, it's quite a strange article. But Bell said, you know, she was driven to write the article through her work with Nelson around the epidemic of violence against women and children in Indigenous communities by Indigenous men. And so she said that she felt compelled to speak out. And actually, you know, much of the article is talking about why it's necessary for her to do this. And as other people have pointed out, Nelson's contributions to the article are very small and they're italicized and they're separate to the main elements of the article, which were clearly written by Bell. It then provoked a large debate after a group of Indigenous scholars and lawyers wrote to the journal asking for a right of reply. And the head author was Jackie Huggins, who's a very well-known and respected Indigenous historian. Mm-hmm. And they were not allowed to give a right of reply. Eventually, they were given a short space for a letter alongside another kind of full-length article by Diane Bell. And it then became a debate in anthropology in Australia. It also became a public debate in the sense that it was discussed on the national broadcaster. And Diane Bell wrote a series of responses, and a number of kind of prominent feminist theorists in Australia, including Sarah Ahmed, Anna Yateman, also contributed to it. And the debate was essentially about responding to this claim that, you know, Bell, as a white woman working in the Northern Territory who saw violence, was therefore compelled to speak about it. And she justified that, as I say, in a series of articles, and made clear that she saw her role as a feminist, and she talked a lot about her position as a feminist, and I talk about her as a feminist expert. And she made clear that her role as a feminist expert was actually primarily to speak rather than to listen, to hear, or even to amplify. It's quite a complex debate. It's hard to really distill the essence of it.
Well, you do a great job of, I think, you know, untangling and discussing it in the book.
Yeah, in the book.
Yes, please go on. I think it's it makes the point really well.
Well, people should just read the whole chapter. But so what I try to do in the chapter in the book is unpack the basis of that claim and look at the ways in which it was contested. And it was relatively successfully contested in that a number of speakers, you know, of varying types within Australian feminism did contest Bell's claim, but she never did. She never accepted it. And so what I argue is that in that case, you have a almost deliberate conflation of the role of the feminist as being able to speak on behalf of and for other women, but also to buttress that through speaking through expertise. So she uses her academic expertise, her position of relative power, to put her own speech and own analysis and make that primary. And she doesn't actually engage in a practice of listening or in a practice of solidarity or even in a practice of speaking with. You know, it becomes a matter of speaking on her own behalf and of refusing that role of listening. And part of that, I think, is because there hasn't been a real reckoning. There hadn't, I guess, been at that time a real reckoning within feminist theorization about the different roles that are given to experts, about the role of expertise. And so what I argue is that the Indigenous women that she is speaking on behalf of and about become positioned as the kind of the raw material of experience, that she sees them, you know, solely in that kind of form, that they've got this pain, this trauma, this emotion that she then uses to put forward, you know, her particular political analysis, you know, in a way that, you know, furthers an academic career and that doesn't engage with the necessity of listening. Instead, and what Sarah Ahmed talks about is the need for a feminism that can be silent and can receive, that can hear the words of women who haven't traditionally been empowered within feminism as a gift and a particularly precious gift that needs to actually be valued and responded to. And so for me, I mean, that's the most kind of powerful example of the need for silence and listening. Because one of the other things that I talk about in the book is, you know, we've talked about silence being needed to be broken. Within the most feminist discourse on this question, silence is only ever portrayed as negative. and speech is portrayed as positive. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so one of the things that I'm interested in following, you know, people like Leotard and also Wendy Brown, is the way that both silence and speech are phrases within discourse and can be used for different political ends. But the silence of listening and valuing feminism as a community of listeners, you know, and active listeners who can, you know, engage, respond, disseminate, amplify, do those kinds of things, is a really underthought part of feminist politics. So I also return to kind of, you know, classic texts that thinking through Spivak's notion of the subaltern and mm-hmm. what it means mm-hmm. for the feminist intellectual to listen and to speak with rather than to speak on behalf of. And I think as a kind of political and ethical challenge for feminism, that the politics of listening and of creating that space, you know, need to be further engaged with and haven't been adequately engaged with. And this relates to the second question about the utopian horizon and thinking beyond speech. And this, you know, I come back to Tarana Burke to talk about this. So when I was thinking about speech and silence, I kind of talk about, you know, so what happens after Me Too and the different visions for after Me Too given by Alyssa Milano and given by Tarana Burke. And Alyssa Milano, in the aftermath of Me Too, set up an organization with some other celebrities, and you can find the website, and it was called Keep Talking. And they released this kind of educational video that starts and it says, everyone knows what's been going on. And, you know, they're talking about sexual harassment and violence. And it goes for about 2 minutes. And it says, everybody knows what's been going on. It goes through. And then by the end, it's saying, we need to keep talking so that everybody knows what's been going on. And what's quite striking about the video is it's a circle. You know, there's no vision beyond speech and continuing to speak. And this, I think, is the dystopian moment of the mm-hmm. project of speaking out, which, you know, and you talked about the ending of the book being ambivalent. And I think it is. And I think ambivalent is probably the right word, because I'm actually very positive about the political efficacy of speaking out, if you think about it, you know, in terms of a transformation, particularly from the late 1960s to today, like the cultural, the political power and efficacy that it's had. Where I am negative or, you know, lack hope is that I do think as a politics, it's become reified or stalled, and you do end up mm-hmm. in this vision where it becomes, you know, the end is that speech is always important, that the survivors have to continue to keep speaking. And, you know, for me, as someone who does write, you know, as a survivor who's written a little bit about my own experience, that's a dystopian vision. You know, the idea that you're asking women and other survivors to continue, you know, to speak endlessly, this keep talking hashtag set up by Alyssa Milano. It's not a vision of political change, actually. And it's in its own way, you know, if you follow it through to its logical conclusion, as politically constricting as not being able to speak at all. Now, what Tarana Burke speaks about in the aftermath of Me Too is quite different. And so she speaks about, you know, the fact that we need to move beyond having a conversation. You know, there's no point just having a conversation. And she says, you know, if we think about Me Too, and I suppose this is particularly apt these days, but she says, you know, if we think about sexual violence in the context of a contagious disease, and we had the same numbers of people as we know are experiencing sexual violence falling ill because of a contagious disease, all the resources of the state would be mobilized in order to prevent that disease. And we don't do that around sexual violence, not because we don't know that it's happening, you know, because we do. We've been speaking about it. We have the statistics for at least the last 50 years, but because we don't put the same political valuation on it. And we don't see it as requiring the same effort. And so for her, the point of something like Me Too is to open the space to change that political valuation. And that's also what I argue at the end of the book. You know, and I talk, and we've been talking about breaking the silence a lot, and I use a metaphor that I'm quite fond of, which is that, you know, within feminist writing and speech, breaking the silence is often imagined in a way, you know, that is like throwing a rock through a pane of glass. You know, the silence is the pane of glass. You throw the rock, you end up on the other side. But we know after 50 years of breaking the silence, of having the silence come back, we know that that's not what happens. Instead, I think we need to think about it differently. And what's important is not to say, therefore, speaking out is valueless, therefore there's no political value to it at all, but to say, yes, you know, we have used stories incredibly effectively politically. You know, they are tools, they are a rock that we can throw, but we don't throw them through a pane of glass. We throw them into a pond, you know, and it creates ripples. You know, it creates the possibility for change. You know, it leaves, you know, it tears away that veneer of kind of normalcy and everything being fine. But if nothing else happens, eventually the ripples settle down and you go back. So it's almost, I don't want to say a pre-political act, but, you know, it's a political act that doesn't on its own lead to a transformative or utopian outcome. And the question I think that has been in some ways lost within feminist politics is that question of a transformative or utopian outcome, and seeing speaking out as one tool that can begin to get us there. Rather, it's too often spoken about as though it's the end and it's everything. And when you do that, you actually raise a whole lot of questions about what does it mean for decades upon decades for feminism to be asking, exhorting, you know, women to speak publicly and tell stories of violence and trauma. And that's why, you know, I talk about, can we ask about how we might tell those stories less, not need to tell them in different ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the book actually finishes, which is again kind of very apt where we are now. The final part of the book is the US election of 2016. And to me, that election was very telling in terms of the kinds of where we are in terms of the politics of speaking out. And I suppose that now, particularly that we've seen the electoral defeat of Trump, I think it's very important for feminist activists, for other activists and thinkers around sexual violence, not to fall into the idea that because there's now a president in the US who is more attentive to, you know, women's and survivors' stories, who's more willing to enact criminal justice legislation around sexual violence, that the political project is over or solved. Now, what is interesting, I think, is you had women coming forward to speak about Trump. And Trump's response to that was to go back to a very old playbook around sexual violence, you know, to deny their stories, to call them liars, those kinds of things, but also to hold a press conference with a group of women who have for many years spoken publicly about Bill Clinton, you know, the husband of Hillary Clinton, the other candidate, and to say that what he was doing was enabling them to speak out about sexual violence. And Juanita Broderick, actually, who is one of those women and who first publicly spoke out about Bill Clinton on a major American news channel, and I can't remember if it was ABC or CBS, gave a long hour-long interview about her experience of being raped by Bill Clinton and has continued to speak about it for decades, actually started as a Democrat and has moved further and further to the right politically because she says it is only people on the conservative side of American politics who've been willing to hear and validate her story. And she's been, you know, very publicly kind of criticized or downplayed by very prominent feminists in the US. So what is important there, I think, is that it's not impossible, even though we might want to think it is, to mobilize narratives of sexual violence and the affective and cultural power they have towards conservative ends. And this is also kind of where my project began, you know, in terms of this moral panic around a very racialized discourse around supposedly Muslim men, you know, seeking out white women to rape, that that was talking about the affective power of women's stories. So to think that the political moral or the political outcome of narratives of sexual violence is automatic or predetermined is wrong, I think, that it's going to get us somewhere politically that is obvious or that it couldn't end up being used for other political purposes. And I think taking the idea of this as narrative politics, which I haven't talked that much about, seriously to me is about saying, you know, politics allows for different outcomes. Things can be mobilized towards different ends. It's not a moral tool as such, it's a political tool, and it can be mobilized politically in different ways. And the point is, to go back to the idea of Tarana Burke or the idea of the pond, the point is to think about how those stories are mobilized politically and to see them much more kind of consciously as political tools. And part of that for me is also thinking about what narrative does and can do, and if we can use narrative differently in order to change the framing, to change the limits of the stories, to engage in some of those kinds of tactics and strategies that Derrida talks about in terms of resisting the law of genre through the laws of the law of genre, you know, through the kind of principles of contamination, and using that to somehow get us somewhere else. So in the end, I think that speaking out is still a useful politics, but that we need to think about it and use it differently.
Well, Tanya, thank you for this. I think you've written a book that certainly should be a classic now, and I think will certainly in time be seen as a classic, because you have brought together such a rich range of material and reflected on it so deeply. And I think the explanation that you just gave on what I was calling ambivalence, but in fact is a more nuanced way to think about the problem of political valuation. Speaking out is about rape and sexual violence is a form of political speech, but as with all meaning-generating practices, and that's what speaking is, that it generates meaning, that meaning needs to be associated with value and how it is going to be valued by whom and in what way. And I think that's what gives any kind of political sense. And if you see speaking and listening as practices of sense-making, how do you make sense of an event? How do we make sense of what we see and encounter in the world? Then it is only by reflecting on the meanings produced by that activity of speaking and listening that I think we can make political advances. And I think I will continue to reflect and think about the important discussions and insights in this book, Speaking Out. And I thank you very much for joining us on Countersign.
Oh, and thank you. As I said before, thank you for taking the time and for the very close and careful reading and the very challenging but useful questions.
You've been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.